It's time for Plain Living for Alabama and the Gulf Coast. With nationally recognized nature writer and award-winning horticulture and nature expert, Bill Finch. Bill shares his knowledge of conservation, natural history, and gardening. Let's talk about living and growing in the Deep South with your personal garden and nature consultant. Here's Bill Finch on FM Talk 106.5.
All right, welcome back. It's Gulf Coast Sunday morning. It's in Alabama. Sunday morning, for many, it will be a very rainy Sunday morning. And as I said to Steve, I think there are probably tomato warnings out all over. So seriously, though, there are some tornado warnings out. Be careful. I am of a mind to talk about gardens today, apparently. So I do have tomatoes on my mind. I have okra on my mind. I got vines on my mind. But I promised Don last week that we were going to talk about shorelines. We were going to talk about Alabama's beaches. And we're going to talk about Alabama's beaches in maybe ways you've never thought about before. We're going to go look at about 350 or so million years of beaches in Alabama. Because if you understand those beaches, if you understand those shorelines, you're going to understand something about Alabama and why it is and why it's such a cool place. Not because of you. Because it was cool before you got here. And we're going to understand a little bit about maybe you want to think a little bit about the future, too. Would you want to do that? I don't know, but let's get started. Let's think about these beaches in Alabama. And so, Don, here's the funny part. We really do have to go back about, we're going to go back about 350 million years. I can't see much past that. That's about as far back as I can see. But I'll tell you, there was a beach in Alabama 350 million years ago. Most of Alabama was under the ocean in those days. There was, but this is what's cool about Alabama. There was a little bit of Alabama stretching down even into parts of places south of Birmingham. A little strip, almost a little peninsula, not very wide, that stretched down in about this dry land during the Pennsylvanian period, during the Mississippian period. I guess it probably was under the ocean too. But there was a little bit of shoreline here, but it was only in certain parts of the state. Really amazing. Most of the state was covered by water. And why does that matter to you? Because the ground you're standing on was developed under these old shores, under these old shorelines, under these old shallow seas that used to cover Alabama. So if you're going to understand the Tennessee Valley, if you're going to understand why Birmingham became a great center of iron production, why Birmingham is where it is, and how Mobile prospered by Birmingham's ascendants. To understand all those things, you got to understand this was all being deposited under this huge shoreline. And one of the things that happens off of shorelines, which are very interesting, is that you get these little creatures, which are going to play a much larger role in your life than you could ever imagine. Maybe more than you'll ever know, because you probably won't want to think about it, but I'm going to make you think about it a little bit, are these little creatures called coccolithophores, and they're little tiny, if you could imagine a conch shell. Anybody know what a conch shell is? Anybody remember what conchs are? We used to know that along the Gulf Coast, when we still called it Gulf of Mexico. Little conch shells. And these teeny tiny microscopic conch shells just rained down in these seas, and they created this limestone base. And they did it over and over. There were some other things going on. There were some other things raining down. But the coccolithophores, they play a huge role. Teeny tiny things. And that explains all that limestone. And it explains some of the other things that are going on. But without the limestone, without that limestone and that Cumberland Sea, you never would have had Birmingham. But then things began to dry out a little bit in North America, and we got this thing called the Appalachian orogeny, where the Appalachians suddenly began rising pretty prominently late in the Pennsylvanian period. Oh, let's call that 250 million years ago. And the mountains kept growing, and it actually was several different orogenies that went on for a long time. Mountain building. And that mountain building basically created much of what we now know as the dry land of North Alabama, north of Montgomery, up north of north and northeast of Tuscaloosa, kind of a line that runs through the state. It was dry land, and so by the time the dinosaurs were around, they weren't around in the Mississippian and Pennsylvanian era, by the way. When they came around, oh, shoot, maybe 150 million years ago, 175 million years ago, up to about, let's say, 80 million or so years ago, 80 to 60 million years ago. That was the age of the dinosaurs. Seems like a long time ago. Not as long ago as when the ocean was first there. And then suddenly you had all these dinosaurs wandering over North Alabama, where it was dry. Dry land, because the Appalachians had arisen. And the shoreline, believe it or not, when the dinosaurs were here, was right there at Montgomery. Wetumpka, if you've ever been to Wetumpka, really a cool little place. Oh, it's a little overrun now, but it's a cool little place, beautiful little hill, side of something very sacred called Hickory Ground. When you look off the If you look off the bluffs there at Wetumpka, you're going to look out over a very, you can see that it's much lower. That was the old shoreline. That was the old edge of the ocean. And it stretched up back through Tuscaloosa. One side of Tuscaloosa was ocean. And the other side of Tuscaloosa was dry land. That was when the dinosaurs were here. And it stretched up. And that means that right below Tuscaloosa and right below Wetumpka, right about where Montgomery is and farther south, you had this big shallow sea that we call the Cretaceous Ocean, the Dinosaur Ocean, if you will. There were the dinosaurs that were in that ocean were big, big, giant, flesh-eating, whale-like creatures. Among other things, but they're really cool to talk about. And people began discovering them in this area we call the Black Belt. And the Black Belt was this prairie, another limestone area, because of all those coccolithophores. And that prairie was really interesting, and that those soils were really interesting because of all that rain of coccolithophores. There was the other shoreline of Alabama, and, you know, moderately recent. And then it began retreating again and again and again as climate changed. And then we had what I'll call an Eocene ocean, a quaternary ocean, an ocean where the shoreline was, oh, let's say it was just north of Monroeville. And in that ocean, you got all sorts of interesting coccolithophores and other things depositing on that floor of the ocean. And you got another set of limestone prairies that were developing there. You can always see these oceans by looking for the limestone. Isn't that interesting? And it kept retreating down until, oh, a few million years ago. Getting kind of modern, isn't it? And then we're getting down into Mobile County, and there was a shoreline. And then came the Pleistocene, which really was not very long ago. Tens of thousands of years ago. We'll tell you what happened then.
FM Talk 106.5 with Plain Living for Alabama and the Gulf Coast. Call 251-343-0106. Here again is your personal nature expert, Bill Finch.
Yeah. So, listen, we're talking about Alabama's beaches. We're talking about Alabama's ancient beaches. We're talking about all the beaches that Alabama has had over the years. B-E-A-C-H-E-S, in case you were wondering. All the ancient shorelines that Alabama's had. And here's the funny part. I size up your garden. Listen carefully. I size up your garden by thinking about which shoreline you lived along. You live along. Isn't that interesting? So this is for the whole state. So if you ask me a question in the Tennessee Valley, I'm thinking, okay, what was the shoreline like? If you ask me a question in Birmingham, I'm thinking, okay, what was the shoreline like in Birmingham? If I think about the Black Belt all the time, it's a lovely place, a place I love dearly. And I think about the Jackson Prairies down around Monroeville, stretching up into Mississippi. And I think, I know that shoreline. I know what happened there. And I know what the soils are like. And I know what the gardening is going to be like. And even if you're in Mobile County, I'm thinking, okay, it's all going to depend on when this land emerged from the ocean over the past few thousand years. This has been going on for 350 million years, at least. These shorelines retreating through Alabama, down, 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 until the present day. And fairly recent, when people were first coming, came here. Here's the odd part. Now, people first came to Alabama not that long ago. We were talking about 350 million years ago. And people first came to Alabama. Oh, we've pushed it back. Pushed it back pretty good now. But we've only been here, oh, maybe 25,000 years. At best. That's a long short of 350 million years. And when people first came here, here's what was happening. The shoreline was south of Dauphin Island. Ha! Way south of Dauphin Island. Dauphin Island was a series of hills and a big landscape. That ocean was retreating. So the delta and that ocean were 80 miles south of the current shoreline. Wow. Oh, boy, howdy. And then it began filling back in, so that only in the past 2,000 or 3,000 years, did the modern delta form. Very recent by any standard. Certainly by 350 million years, when all those other shorelines in Alabama were developing. But each one of those shorelines contributed something very important, which is a limestone base, which makes Alabama very different than most states. And one of the other things, what's driving all those changes in shorelines? And I have to think about that a lot. I think about it more and more. And it's climate. And climate has changed. And climate will continue to change. Slowly, quickly, who knows? But we have some evidence that it may be happening faster now. So we got to think about, okay, what's happened in the past to these shorelines and what's going to happen to the shoreline now? And how fast is that going to happen? Think about it. Research it. Figure it out. Make sure you get ideas from lots of people. That's good. The people who know more about the science of shorelines probably know more about what's going to happen and of climate. But that's really important to understanding where you are, understanding those shorelines, understanding that it has happened, understanding that climate changes, understanding that it affects how you garden and what your soils are like. It's really fun to think about. Oh, boy, do I love to think about it in the Red Hills of Alabama. Those of you who are up there, if you know where that is, south of the Black Belt, and you're getting all these shorelines, each with a slightly different complexion, each with a slightly different soil base, and it makes these Red Hills area particularly rich. It's really unusual. The center of oak diversity in North America. Probably the center of Magnolia diversity, pretty near it. Probably the center of lots of other things in terms of diversity, if we measured correctly and if we thought about it. It's really cool to think about all those shorelines. So, good thing to think about as you're gardening. But give us a call this morning. I'm thinking about all these ancient shorelines. And at the same time, thinking about butter beans. And I can't help it. Listen, I got a ton of butter beans. I got to shell them. I did. I shelled them. I got all the pods. I got to figure out what to do with them before my wife sees them. But here's the thing. Butter beans are really cool. And why do I think they're cool? Because it's the other thing I wanted to talk about today, which is so really much a part of Alabama, we don't think about it enough, are vines. And vines are really cool. My whole garden, and you should think about this too, is built around vines. And if you don't ask me a lot of questions, we're going to talk a lot about vines today, but I hope you will ask me some questions. But here's the great thing. I just realized I'm sitting there looking at these butter beans. They're beautiful. Somebody thinks I'm growing little bush butter beans. They ain't worth the trouble, I'll just tell you. Pole butter beans are amazing. They're delicious. They're traditional. They're prolific. And they're beautiful. You know, I people often ask me, you know, what I think about the city-county government complex. And I think it could be worse. It could be a giant ballroom. But here's the thing. There's nothing about that building that couldn't be improved with butterbean vines. They're beautiful. And I've always thought, you know, here's how we should fix that building. We should plant butter beans on it. Just let those vines grow up. It's really interesting. You used to look at houses around Mobile, and the porches were covered in butter beans, called butter bean shade. We don't talk about butter bean shade as much as we used to. We should talk about it all the time. It's a great way of thinking about how you live, how you build your house, and the butter beans climbing up. They actually built special things on the porches to allow the butter beans to climb up. Isn't that cool? And other vines. Vines were part of our heritage. It's also interesting. Alabama is the center of vine diversity in North America. Oh, Alabama and Arkansas. Got more vines per square whatever. Square mile than any other place. Yeah, that's probably pretty good. More vines per square mile, certainly per 10,000 square kilometers than any place else in North America. Just vines everywhere north of Mexico. And it's an absolutely incredible place for vines, and we don't think about them enough. So we're going to talk a little bit about preparing your gardens for vines for next year. Begin thinking about that. I'm going to assess the vines that I had this year and how well they do. We're going to talk about butter beans for vines for butter beans, vines for squash, vines for cucumbers. We're going to talk about creating a trellis for all those. We're going to talk about how tomatoes are essentially vining plants. Essentially vining plants and how we can prepare for that. And we're going to talk about melaton too, right? You don't know what melaton is? Stick around.
Welcome back to Plain Living for Alabama and the Gulf Coast. Questions on conservation, natural history, and gardening? Talk with Bill Finch. Call 251-343-0106 on FM Talk 1065.
Yeah, welcome back. Gulf Coast Sunday morning, Alabama Sunday morning. So a lot of fun things this morning. I have started a conversation about butter beans that we're going to continue. You know, it's really cool this time of year to look up at my pole butter beans covering the trellis. And I admit, the trellis is a little too high. I always build the trellis a little too high, so I can't get to some of the butter beans easily. Got to stand on my tiptoes. But they're beginning to cover it really nicely. And it's good with this light, this descending light of fall. It just is wonderful, descending light throughout the day, and you know, there's something about that fall light. I can see through the butter beans, and I know exactly when they're filled to the right place. Butter beans. Butter beans, I said, Bruce. And you can see through those butter beans, and you actually know when they filled out just right. I don't wait for my butter beans to dry out on the pod, except when I want to collect the seeds. Now, if you could wait and you had the patience, you could just let them all dry out and then you could eat them sometime in January. But why would I do that when I can eat them now? And they're really good and they're really sweet. If you've never had a butter bean off the vine, when they're still young, just before they begin to color, still greenish, just try one. Incredibly sweet. Just raw. Just pop it in the garden. Put it in your mouth. Don't be a baby. Just eat it. It's really good. Not going to hurt you. Really sweet. Incredible, those butter beans. I love butter beans. Now, these are really good butter beans. What's the difference between a butter bean and a lima? We're going to get to that. Basically, there isn't a difference, except that limas are basically what you buy in a package at the grocery store. And butter beans are what you grow yourself. Because you can't get butter beans in the stores anymore. Not really. Butter beans are what we ate fresh out of the garden. Really nice thing. You can dry them too. That's nice as well. And the ones you dry yourself will probably be better than the ones you buy in the store. Dried. But butter beans. We're going to talk more about butter beans. Talk more about vines too. But got some good questions. And David Hubble is giving us some suggestions about cooking butter beans. We're going to talk about those. But I had a question about satsumas this morning. And this is a good time to ask those questions. The question was, I planted my satsuma. The texter says, I planted my satsuma a few back this spring. And that's perfect. The perfect time. 3 feet tall. Let's assume it grew a little bit. Rooted in pretty well. Got a little bit of height on it. What do you do now? Well, first off, let's be clear. Do not fertilize, period. do not, under any circumstance, fertilize that Satsuma now. Do not. Do not. Can I say it again? Do not fertilize that Satsuma now. That would be the worst thing you could possibly do. It's going to have plenty of rain. Don't water it. All that's fine. But here's what you do need to do. We don't know how cold the winter is going to be. And we've run through some few very, very exceptionally mild winters. We've also run through some very exceptionally cold winters. And even worse, the onset of winter and the beginning of spring have been weird. So we went from very warm temperatures to very cold temperatures in a day. And the Satsumas didn't have time to settle down, harden off, and they will. They will harden off. They will lose some of their ability to be damaged by cold. And so, you can run into trouble on that first frost. So what do you do? It definitely, with a young plant, the smartest thing to do, because it doesn't have much of a canopy that's going to protect it, and it's not going to capture a lot of the heat rising out of the ground. There's a lot of heat running out of the ground. A lot of heat coming out of the ground during winter that will protect plants. The ground is this incredible heat source. Always is. And particularly in Alabama. And it will keep things warm, much warmer than the air temperature. But you got to trap that heat. It doesn't have a canopy. So it doesn't really help to just expect the canopy to collect the heat from the ground. Doesn't really even help with a small plant to keep the ground bare because there's so little. We'll come back to that in a minute. But basically, you want to put a tent over this. And I would, on the first chill nights, get it set up so that you can cover the plant. And you want a tent. It's just very simple. You can, because it's a small plant, you can throw up a few stakes. And think about just erecting a tent around your Satsuma. You don't need to do anything else. Find some staples or bricks or something to hold the edges so that the tent doesn't just blow around in the wind. And on those first nights when it's predicted to get below 28 degrees, throw that tent over it. Don't worry when it's 32. It'll be fine. In fact, that's probably good for it to get used to 32 degrees. But when the weather forecast is calling for 28 degrees or below, you need to cover it. And particularly the first time round, particularly the first episode of 28 degrees and below, put your tent around it. That's the most important thing. The second, if later in the year we got a forecast, even though your plant is kind of inured to all this cold, which it can get inured, used to, later in the year, if we get a cold spell below, say, 22 degrees, 22 to 24 degrees, you'll need to put that thing on there again. So, and just for those nights, and then when those nights disappear, you don't need to keep it covered. It's good to have 32 degrees. It's good to have 40 degrees. All those things are good for your Satsuma. Just watch for those nights when it gets below 28. That's all you need to do. All you need to do. If you've got an older Satsuma, that has a good canopy, one of the things you can do is to get rid of all the weeds underneath it. That can make a big difference. Get rid of the grass underneath it. It can actually make a big difference. Get rid of the grass and the weeds underneath it. And if you've got a mulch under it, just rake the mulch back. particularly as we're coming into these cold nights, so that the ground will absorb that heat and re-radiate it into the canopy. It works. It works. Auburn's. It wasn't natural for me to think about this, I'll say, but Auburn did the research, and some folks who were at Auburn a number of years ago, and they demonstrated that, yeah, it makes a difference in how well your tree survives, because it allows the ground to absorb heat from the sun and re-radiate it into the canopy. Pretty cool, isn't it? If you put a mulch down under the tree, it doesn't protect the tree. It actually makes the tree more vulnerable. Isn't that interesting? We should talk about mulches. But now's the time to start thinking about it. We got a couple more weeks, three more weeks, four more weeks, depending on where you are, before we really have to worry about frost and extremely cold weather. But it's, you know, we'll have it. So that's the thing with the Satsumas now. That's the thing with Satsumas. Do not fertilize. Don't do anything else except think about what your tent is going to be like if you have a young Satsuma. How are you going to make your tent? That's all you got to do is think about it. Oh, make a pretty tent. You know, you do it with a sheet. A sheet will actually probably work pretty well on most nights. A blue tarp will work okay. Don't do it with clear plastic. And there's several reasons why I would not recommend doing it with clear plastic, particularly if that plastic touches the leaves of the Satsuma. It doesn't seem to be as big a problem with things like sheets or just blankets, whatever, or even with a blue tarp. But clear plastic causes a lot of problems. Don't use clear plastic. Bad idea. You just want to make a nice tent. You could use a tent, for that matter. If you got an old-fashioned pup tent, I could see it working quite well. But you want to close those ends down. That canvas fabric would be really nice. But you want a tent. That's the one thing you have to have for these young Satsumas. As they get a little older, the tent is less necessary, but on those extremely cold nights, you're still going to want to think about it. You're still going to want to think about that tent. But right now, you need a tent. All right, let's see. What else we got? More. Let's talk about crepe myrtle pruning and use them for a trellis. That's good. So Don is running the show this morning. It's all right, Don. You always got good questions. And so Don wanted me to talk about shorelines, and we are. And since I am talking about vines, we need to talk about what we're going to train those vines on. And since I'm talking about tents, I got to talk about, okay, what kind of pole are we going to use to erect our tent? And so maybe we talk about pruning crepe myrtles and what crepe myrtle's greatest value in my mind is right now, cutting it down to make poles. Wow, really great poles. Pretty, works pretty well. They're pretty straight sometimes. Even if they're not straight, they're kind of pretty. And the wood lasts no longer than some things, certainly longer than sycamore, certainly longer than privet. The wood will last a while, and it's kind of good in contact with the ground. And so we're going to talk about how to make trellises. We'll be back.
Get Plain Talk on Plain Living. Let's talk about living and growing in the Deep South with Bill Finch. Call 251-343-0106 on FM Talk 106.5.
Hey, welcome back. It's a Gulf Coast Sunday morning. It's an Alabama Sunday morning. It's a Mississippi and a Northwest Florida Sunday morning. It's even a Georgia Sunday morning. And, you know, I think it's going to be a Tennessee Sunday morning before long. We've had some listeners in Tennessee. And we've had a lot of interesting things to talk about today. Shorelines and butter beans and satsumas. Lots of interesting things. Bruce, speaking of butter beans, Bruce said, "Oh, you said butter beans?" And Bruce sent me a picture of his butter beans, which are immense. I mean, butter beans are so incredibly cool. Now, I'm not talking about bush butter beans. Bush butter beans are so amazingly uncool. I mean, just the most uncool things I could possibly think of. And that's all right. You don't have to tell me if you're growing bush butter beans, but you want to be cool. You want to be cool and grow some pole butter beans. That's a traditional southern butter beans. They're so good. They're so incredibly prolific, and they're beautiful. And, you know, you got something you want to cover. Kudzu's going to take a while. Oh, goodness gracious. I'm going to get all you kudzu folks coming out of the woods here. But listen, butter beans. Alabama grows all sorts of vines very fast. Kudzu, I could give you a dozen native vines that are going to grow as fast as kudzu does. Just looking along the river the other day and looking at pipe vine, and you know, people would look at that and think, God, that's kudzu's covering the river, and it's all our native pipe vine. It's a beautiful thing. Vines grow well here. They all grow well. And butter beans will cover things very quickly, much quicker than kudzu. They don't persist like kudzu. You got to replant them every year. And so B-Dark says, when am I going to start? Don't start your butter beans now. They love it warm. It's interesting. I don't think, and those of you who grow a lot of pole butter beans, you argue with me. I think that, in my experience, along the Gulf Coast, if you plant your butter beans early, you kind of have to go through a long period where they're not going to produce a lot in July. So I plant them a little late on the Gulf Coast. I would say May-ish is probably a good time, and they're going to get really prolific this time of year. And you could even plant them probably as late as June, and they'd probably do just fine. So a little later. And if you're on the Tennessee line, if you're up in that old Mississippian, Pennsylvanian shoreline, under what used to be the Cumberland Ocean, Cumberland Sea, if you're up on those areas and the limestone up there, I'd wait. You know, I'd probably plant late April, early May, just about the same. So you end up planting butter beans at about the same time throughout Alabama, but they're going to like it warm. They're going to prefer warm nights, but they're not going to produce as well during the heat and the rains of mid-July. I'm not sure which has the most effect. But they don't produce as well. They're really going to start producing well in late August, September, October. And then in November, you're still going to be picking butter beans if you're on the Gulf Coast. There it is. So there it is, B-Dark. Which butter beans? Oh, this is the question. So there's so many different kinds out there. I am right now, I've been saving one called Alabama Black Eye Butter Beans. And it's a fine butter bean. I don't know that it's the best butter bean. I don't think it necessarily is. It's just I've been saving it for a while, and I just happen to have the seeds, and they've been coming up. They've been producing, and they've been coming up every year. I probably ought to try some other varieties where I am now to see how they do. And that can be Florida Speckled, the ones they call Florida Speckled. It could be Christmas. Somebody call it Christmas Lima, Christmas Butterbean. There's a whole bunch of them. There's a few butter beans that were bred for growing farther north. I don't recommend those if you're in Alabama. Look for the varieties that grow well here in the South. The speckled butter beans are generally pretty reliable, and there's a bunch of different kinds. And they all have different colors. They're really cool. You can get them from places like Southern Exposure. Usually, even local seed stores, local farm stores will have the speckled varieties, and you can try those there. They're great. They all do really good. Great butter beans. Great butter beans. Let's see. David says, I planted butter beans around April and usually get two crops off the same vines. They peter out in summer but come back in the fall, and there you go. And I think that's true. So if you can get them in the ground and get them producing before June, you're going to get a crop, and then you'll get another crop in fall. I've sometimes had a hard time hitting that June window just right in my garden, which is why I sometimes recommend delaying. But I think to get that June window, you'd probably plant them the 1st of April. David is what I'm guessing David is doing, but so he's getting those two crops of butter beans, and that's a good thing to do. But he is confirming they do sort of drop down on the Gulf Coast. If you're farther north, they're going to start producing in July. But they're going to do better in August, September, October, when the nights get just a little bit cooler and we get a little bit less rain. You ain't got a little handful of seed to spare, do you? I got a po' box. All right. Yeah, but they're not expensive. That's a good thing about it. And the good thing is I'm a little cheap, I guess. I hate having to buy seed every year, so I just save, and that's why I'm growing Alabama black-eyed, because I can save the seed every year. If I had really started to do this when I was growing Florida Speckled, I might be growing Florida Speckled every year from seed I was keeping myself. But it's really easy to keep lima bean seed year after year. What you got to do is you got to build a trellis, and building the trellis is a fun thing, and we should. Now is not the time of year when you're going to need it. You're going to need a trellis less, but you're definitely going to need a trellis. You're definitely going to need a trellis for next year if you're going to live and grow and have a great garden and lots of produce here in Alabama. Trellises are the stuff of gardens here. Building something for vines to climb on. You can grow them lots of different ways. You can grow them lots of different ways. All right, we're going to take a break. We're going to be back. We got lots of things to follow up on.
And the rain pours down like a holy waterfall over the Gulf.
It's time for Plain Living for Alabama and the Gulf Coast. With nationally recognized nature writer and award-winning horticulture and nature expert, Bill Finch. Bill shares his knowledge of conservation, natural history, and gardening. Let's talk about living and growing in the Deep South with your personal garden and nature consultant. Here's Bill Finch on FM Talk 106.5.
Mm-hmm. Welcome back. It's a Gulf Coast Sunday morning. It's an Alabama Sunday morning, Florida Sunday morning, Mississippi Sunday morning, morning in Louisiana, morning in Tennessee. That's the region. Oh, folks, goodness gracious, we got folks in Georgia. Perry, I'm so sorry. So we have to be careful about how we pronounce, you know, P-E-C-A-N. So we got folks all over. And we talk about how to grow things there, and we talked about shorelines. I didn't talk about that shoreline. You know, it's interesting. We've talked about the old shorelines, and where did the Gulf of Mexico used to go? And that's kind of going back a ways. It's kind of not even useful to call it the Gulf of Mexico, because you got to call it something like the Cumberland Sea. And so it was the Cumberland Sea back, 350 million years ago. It covered a lot of Alabama, made Alabama what it is. And so did that Cretaceous Ocean going back, about 60 to 150, 175 million years ago. It made Alabama what it is, too. It made the Black Belt. It made some really cool things going on, which then the Black Belt really set the politics of modern Alabama, for better or for worse. Understanding coccolithophores, the little creatures, the little tiny conch creatures that were on that shoreline when the Gulf of Mexico was beating against the dry land at Montgomery. Goodness gracious. That made the Black Belt. And then it kept retreating over tens of millions of years. Isn't that just amazing? Down, down, down through Evergreen, Greenville, and then Evergreen. Each time it retreated, it created a little different kind of soil, a little different shorelines, down through Monroeville, down through Washington County, down into the Miocene, down into Mobile County, down until the sea retreated all the way to 80 miles south of Dolphin Island. Not all that long ago when people first came to Alabama, and then the sea rebounded as climate warmed all the way back up so that it created the modern Mobile-Tensaw Delta where it is, and the modern beaches of Alabama developed over the past fairly recent time. Almost measurable in centuries, but pretty recently. And, you know, there's a lot of lessons in that. A lot of understanding about, that's how I figure out what I'm going to tell you about what to grow in your garden based on which shoreline you lived on. And it also helps me figure out, gosh, what do I understand about climate and how is that going to change? What is the influence of the Gulf of Mexico, which has been huge? I mean, what an incredible flywheel the Gulf has been over the years. It's one of the reasons why climate has changed less dramatically here in Alabama than in other places, even though it has changed. And it's why we have a storehouse of species. We'll talk more about that if you dare. It's a good, interesting thing. But we played a great song by Sean Mullins called The Gulf of Mexico, leading in. Sean Mullins, for those who are asking, really, really great song. Sean Mullins, Gulf of Mexico, call from Haleyville. I love that song. It's really, really a beautiful, beautiful song. We don't hear much from Sean Mullins anymore. He kind of had some great songs in the 90s and early 2000s, I think. But that's one of the really nice ones. Perry, I picked on you just a little bit. Just a little bit. Because it's my fault. Because I forgot to mention Georgia. That's a terrible thing to do. And B-Dark is all excited about butterbean shade. So let's come back to this butterbean shade thing. Listen, B-Dark, this is a term. This is the kind of term that every Southerner should know. Every Southerner should know. Butterbean shade. It was very much a part of our lives. You can read about it, a lot of books used to talk about butterbean shade, and it was something people use butterbeans for shade. Bruce can attest to that. Bruce can tell you, oh, yeah, it'll work, because butterbeans traditionally grew up. They weren't these little dwarf little things that you had to have some big machine that that was the price of a Rolls Royce come in and harvest. It was something that you grew up on a trellis, and that's really cool about butterbeans. And my butterbeans are producing now. And you know, I would say if I were gonna get beans, butterbeans, and I wanted a good place to start, I would go to Southern Exposure. And they've got, I'm looking at how many varieties. Oh, they got a bunch of them. And they're all pretty good. And you're not going to plant them this time of year. You could just begin sort of thinking about, oh, what can I do next year while the rest of us are out picking our butter beans? And there's some good ones here. The Alabama Black Eye Pole Lima Bean. Don't get stuck on it just because it's from Alabama. There's a lot of good ones that have been grown in Alabama over the years. The Aubrey Dean Pole Lima Bean looks awful pretty. It's from Greene County, Virginia. Christmas Large Speckled Calico. That was the other name I couldn't think about. Calico beans, calico butter beans. Large Speckled Calico Pole Lima Beans. The Hopi Yellow Pole Lima Bean. I don't think that one does quite as well here. It has good heat tolerance. It seems to get a little moldier, but those of you who've grown it may have a different experience. Was a Ceiba, the Carolina Pole Lima Bean. Small little beans, but absolutely delicious. Make perfect young, sweet beans, and it's a very pretty pole lima bean. Violet's multicolored butter beans, so popular. Bruce grew it and loved it. It was so popular, he called it Miss Violet's multicolored butter beans. They're pole limas, and they're really, really pretty things. Bruce can show you that it does really well. They're out of stock. But, you know, also don't give up on willow leaf colored pole lima beans, which I like a lot. And the leaves are very nice. They're very pretty. And they're really, really very attractive leaves. So they're all there on the southernexposure.com website. Probably one of the best places to start, but that's just a start. That's just your introduction. There's a bunch of different kinds out there. And I highly recommend them. This is the time of year when I'm looking at that sunlight and I can see it streaming through the whole pod, and I can just see the little seeds inside, and I can know just when they're developed. You got to stand on the right side of the pole. You know, you got to let that little evening sun go down. And the evening sun starts going down kind of early here, don't it? And so you're out there even in the middle of the afternoon, and you can see that sun streaming, perfect low light streaming through those butter beans. Your eyes have adjusted to this lower light and you can see that light. So it's just great thing to see that. Really excited about butter beans, excited about beaches, excited about making trellises too. If you want to talk about that, we can certainly talk about it. But B-Dark's got it figured out. You know, you got a porch, you already got a place to set up a trellis. We'll talk about butterbean shade here in just a minute.
FM Talk 106.5, home for plain living for Alabama and the Gulf Coast. Let's talk about living and growing in the Deep South with Bill Finch. Call 251-343-0106.
And all right, boy, we're going to talk about how to grow things on vines, how to grow vines, and what to grow them on. And I'm going to get back to that because there's some good things to do. And Don, who's driving the show today, Don, yeah. So, you know, Don knows when to push my buttons, and he does, and he's pushed all the right buttons today. So he wants me to talk about lashing, and I'm sure that the rest of you are dying for me to talk about lashing, but we're going to talk about it at some point, whether you want me to or not. It's cool, and it's a really cool subject. Don and I both learned how to lash when we were in Boy Scouts. I don't think the Boy Scouts teaches that anymore. But it's a cool thing, lashing. And it's much older than the Boy Scouts. It's an old, nice old thing to do. It's kind of a worldwide thing to do. And we use lashing to hold our trellises together. But B-Dark, you don't even need lashing because you've got a porch. And that's a great way to grow butterbees. And we're going to talk about how people used to do it here. But we got a caller, right? Is that right, Steve? Who's our caller?
Yes, San Francisco.
I'm David.
I believe it's David.
David, how are you? Good to hear from you.
How are you, Bill? Yeah.
Good.
Yeah, I'm glad you're talking about that trellis thing. You know, you probably got kudzu near you, right?
I do. In fact, I have a memorial patch of kudzu that I keep for it's been there a while. It doesn't really spread, and I kind of keep it for my own amusement. But yes, there's a marvelous story to be told about kudzu, and it's not what you think.
I was down in Atlanta in '77, and there was a highway that was covered over with it. It was that highway they were going to try to cross the downtown with, and it was stopped by some civic groups. And the kudzu was totally over the highway. I mean, totally. When you were talking about trellises, I'm just wondering, could you make a trellis out of a kudzu stalk?
No. It tends to disintegrate really easily. It disintegrates really easily. And so I've tried using dried kudzu for... And it's kind of useless for that. We have a lot of other grapevines for that. I will say this about kudzu. The reason why we perceive it to be such a huge thing is because we never get out of our cars. And so every time people drive by, they spend their lives in their cars, and there it is on the roadways in many areas. And if you went into the woods, it really wasn't there much at all. And so the perception was kudzu had taken over a lot of the South, but really only in places along highways. And in places, I was talking to some National Park Service folks in this past week, and it was in Great Smoky Mountains National Park, but only in areas where they prevented animals from getting to it, because anytime a horse or a cow or a goat or a mule
or a deer
or a bison – our deer see kudzu, they're going to eat the stew out of it, and they will eat it into oblivion. So it's deer probably aren't as effective as horses and cows, but anytime we had kudzu when I was growing up on any of my places, my dad's cows and horses ate it up within a year or two, and it was gone. So we'll put our meals on it.
Living out west here, I've lived in I was brought up in St. Louis, but then headed west, and so a lot of places like Colorado, western Kansas, Utah, of course in the south, even in Texas, it's getting to be desert down there, and making a trellis, put a back 40 in trellises or something like that to be able to survive 109 degree temperatures for. What, 2 months? 2 years ago, Texas had 109 for two solid months.
Yeah.
And trellises would have saved the day for every acre of land they had on them. And, to get a niche started here, I've even wondered if you couldn't reclaim the Sahara Desert with trellises. But, it's just it's a matter of time tested. It you can't live up to the fake Wall Street economy to get it done. You got to do it on your own scale. But yeah, it's we could reclaim the earth without too much trouble with a trellis. And then, of course, like if you got jungly, back in St. Louis, they got honeysuckle like no tomorrow, and I could imagine right. making trellises out of some biodegradable trellises, you know, things like that. You could make steel ones or something like that, but why not make have a constant economy with too many vines, you know? What I was wondering, this, of course, this is coming up with the economy. I think I mentioned this in a call a couple of weeks ago. Texas is allowing fracking water to be put on agriculture. So you're not necessarily going to be able to trust the produce out of Texas anymore, because the more fracking water they've got, the more it's going to hit the crops. And the biggest farms, of course, are going to be dumping it. And so I'm just wondering, is there a lot of fracking in Alabama? Are they going to try to start to pull us down there, too?
There's not a lot of fracking in Alabama, and for a variety of reasons. I'm not saying there's none, but it's not as dominant here as it is in some places. I do think we have other water quality problems. A lot of our wells are still producing, and I don't know that a lot of the wells in the Gulf of Mexico are still producing. I don't know whether there's maybe something like fracking going on in the Gulf of Mexico. I'm afraid that that processed water probably goes right into the Gulf of Mexico. I don't think there's as much fracking going on here in a way that is a big problem. There may be some isolated places that I'm less aware of where there is well recovery and they're using fracking, but I don't, in most of Alabama, I think not.
Well, part of the problem of this was that the governor authorized it. And when you think of how big Texas is, isn't that the biggest state in the lower 48, right? So it's over 25%. I've heard it's closer to 30% of the lower 48 states is Texas. And if some dumbass governor says that it's okay to put fracking water on agriculture of Texas, I mean, does that mean it's hay and alfalfa for horses, or is it for the cucumbers and the tasty whether it's corn or whether it's cotton, putting fracking water into it with a signature? Talk about rob you with a fountain pen. That's the whole state all of a sudden gets double teamed like that. And then if Texas can do it, can Alabama do it too? So, yeah, watch out for those signatures on this.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I don't know enough about that decision in Texas to comment on it. But, we'll certainly be thinking about it. I will come back to I'll come back to kudzu real quickly. And, and to trellises. I do think that you can, I do think you can certainly control kudzu, and for anybody who's thinking it's one of the worst things in the world, let me show you the much worse things in the world. But I think you can control kudzu. Trellises, and I'm gonna come back to trellises here. Because we got a lot of callers who are interested in it, and I would say for porches, the
oh sure, but one of the, I'm just thinking exporting them for Alabama's got a lot of vines down there, don't you? You could export them to Utah or something, right?
Yeah, I don't think that's really useful. But we do have a lot of vines. I mean, we're the center of vine diversity. Yeah.
Hey, well, take care. Good morning.
Along about 1825, I left Tennessee very much alive. And I never would have got through the Arkansas mud if I hadn't been a-riding that Tennessee stud.
Welcome back to Plain Living for Alabama and the Gulf Coast with Bill Finch. Ask Bill about gardening and nature in your backyard. Call 251-343-0106 on FM Talk 106.5.
Yeah, here we go. I do want to talk about butter beans. So B-Dark wants to have butter bean shade. And a good old southern term. I think that it could remedy a lot of things. I think we could use butter bean shade a lot more on some really weird buildings like the old Dauphin Way Baptist Church that seems to be abandoned now, and it's like, you know, the little country church on steroids, as someone once said. It's but a little bit of butter bean shade would have helped, maybe help there too. We could think about it around a lot more buildings. I'd love to see that done. We could see it on the city county complex. Oh, I'd love to see some butter bean shade there. Here's what you would do, B-Dark, if you're going to do it. And what people used to do is they would just put a few little nails right along the top, right along the sill, right above the porch, and then run a string down to the ground, and then back up, and back down, back up, and back down. Just those strings. Really cool way to make butterbean shade. You could do it with fishing line at two, except that it doesn't climb fishing line quite as well. It seems to like something with a little texture to climb on. Here's another cool thing about old porches in the South, and particularly if they faced west, a lot of people would actually build the trellis into the porch so that there were horizontal boards running across from post to post on the porch. And you'll see that on a lot of old houses. And they would train the vines up on those. And it didn't just have to be butter beans. There were a lot of great things. You would see things like wisteria, which I don't recommend if it's Asian wisteria, or you will regret it. But you would also see lots of other things like cross vine. Really cool vine. Or Berkemia scandens, which is supplejack. Nice native vine. Or pipe vine, which is a beautiful, beautiful vine, a really cool vine. And you get the pipe vine swallowtails coming all over it. And if you've never seen what a flower the pipe vine swallowtail is, it's that it has that blue that every other butterfly always tries to mimic, because it's such a cool blue. And that beautiful, it's hard to describe it. It's a shimmering sort of pulsing blue that's on the backs of those pipevine swallowtails. And no other butterfly quite gets it as good as the pipevine swallowtail. The pipevine swallowtail blue is exceptional. But lots of other butterflies have that blue as well. But the pipevine swallowtail, inimitable. And it will be all over, like this flower, all over your pipe vines. A really cool thing. Lots of neat vines you can use on your porch. And here's the thing in the garden, and this is kind of what I started the show saying, or when we got into that second segment, our second theme of the morning, and we started talking about vines. If you're going to grow things in your garden, whether it's tomatoes, whether it's beans, whether it's butter beans, whether it's squash, whether it's cucumbers, whether it's melons, whether it's melaton, whether it's rattlesnake, beans, just a whole series of things. Snake beans, as they call them, some other things. Oh, there's a whole series of things that really you need vines to grow them well. And those of you who could play, because I put you onto some of the really great squash and said, gosh, this thing grows forever. It does. But one of the ways we tame that in the South is to put them on vines, put them on trellises. They are viney. Put them on trellises. Let them grow onto those trellises. And you can grow them in a more or less contained space. And it makes finding the fruit a lot easier when you grow them on trellises. You got to build those. I think it's just a part of gardening, learning to build trellises and learning to put them in the ground. I use bamboo a lot. And usually there's always bamboo around you. It's not hard to find. You just got to ask permission to cut it. Or if it's on your yard, you don't even ask permission. You just go and cut it and say, goodness gracious, what a great resource. Good thing. Good thing to have. And you can tie it up, and you tie it up by lashing it. But even if you don't use lashing, there's a lot of ways of doing that. A lot of ways of doing it. Just build yourself a trellis. Learn to build trellises. Think about trellises. That's one of the great keys to gardening. You know, people used to talk about raised beds. And raised beds are important, but only the first 12 inches. When you're talking about building these really high raised beds, you're missing the point of growing things in the South. And people say, oh, I'm got a raised bed because it's easy to pick. No, it's not the raised bed that makes things easy to pick, because most things in the South grow really tall. What makes them easy to pick is putting them on trellises. We need to think more about trellises for ornamentals, for everything else. I mean, when people design landscapes, when people design gardens, how many people design vines into their gardens? Almost no one. And yet what a great resource it is. What beautiful flowers they make. What a lush appearance. A lot of places, I've even said downtown, you know, we discussed this, and it never seems to go anywhere, because it seems we always imitate what people in other cities do up north. And they don't have the vines to use like we do. But what if in downtown areas we used vines? New Orleans does. Traditionally they did. Of course, they're kind of getting away from their traditional self, because they too read books in Boston and forget that, oh, we got our own tradition here. Old Mobile used vines a lot in downtown areas to create passageways for people to walk under. They're much more effective than using those vines. Can be much more effective for providing shade and for providing beauty and a nice area to walk under than trees, in many cases where you don't have as much room. We ought to be thinking about vines more, a lot more. Just a little thing to think about while we're on the subject. Yes, and as David says, melaton can help a lot. You make the best of what we have, it is what it is. That's the bottom line. Those who don't know what we know as front porch trellis with the old school mentality is what Don is ultimately getting back to. Don, we're going to work hard to find something we disagree here on. I know you insist we do. But we're pretty much in agreement on most things here. Someone is writing, can you play the Birmingham native Bob Kane song, I Don't Want No Collard Greens, Just a Bowl of Butter Beans, from Will and Fairhope? I should find that song and play it. I don't know if we have time here before the end of the show. We probably don't. It is I remember it well. I did not realize it was from a Birmingham native. I'll tell you, that is, but it makes sense. It makes sense. Polecat is asking, what is the garden wheel called so I can see what to plant now? And so what Bob is, Polecat is referring to is a, we call it the Plain Gardening Almanac, the Plain Gardening Wonder Wheel. But if you look up Plain Gardening and Wheel, you're probably going to find it on the internet. Let me just do it now and see if that doesn't happen. See if it doesn't magically appear here. Plain Gardening, two words, and Wheel, Almanac. Oh, there it is. It's already coming up with Almanac. Let's see if it shows Gardening Almanac. Okay, let's see. Plain Gardening. It's not showing up. Hold on. We're going to find it. I'm just getting inundated by Farmer's Almanac. Let's try Plain Gardening Wheel. Planting Wheel. And see if we don't get it. Yep, there it is. So look up Plain Gardening and Planting Wheel, and you'll probably see it. It's still available on AL.com. You'll still see it. Plain Gardening Planting Cycle is still there. So you can find it. It's a pretty good little wheel that I developed a number of years ago, many years ago. Could it be better? Yes. Will it be better? No, because we don't have a newspaper anymore. And because we don't have a real way of distributing that, and because I got lots of other things going on, but it's really fun to see to see it all laid out there on a wheel, and it's really nice to understand it as a wheel, and it's cool. So you can go on the internet and you can see it, and you can get a good sense of what to start planting this time of year. You know, we're still pretty good. We're still in a good planting season. You can still probably do some things with your broccoli and collards and kale and other things if they're sizable now. You don't want to start them from seed. It's quite possible that you can, cilantro should do very well. Even radishes on the Gulf Coast are going to do very well right now. Carrots should do pretty well on the Gulf Coast planted right about now. Cabbages, probably you can do okay if you can find some sizable cabbages. I don't think I would start them from seed right now because the days are getting too short. If you've got ruby chard, chard should do very well planted right now if the plants have a little bit of size on them. If they're in containers and you can plant them out, a lot of great things to be planting right now. Fava beans, a great time to plant. Garlic, it's a great time to plant garlic. A lot of us will be getting our garlic orders. They're finally going to be arriving. They never arrive soon enough. Is that not right, Jim from Georgetown? But we'll be seeing those soon.
Thursday night at 7, Auburn fans can weigh in with Tiger Talk OT. Doug Holton takes your calls on the Morgan Bradley Alpha Hotline, 343-0106. Morgan Bradley at Fountain Square in Daphne, a proud sponsor of Tiger Talk OT on FM Talk 106.5.
This is Chris Francis. If you need a tree removed, you can call me, but let's face it, there are a lot of tree guys capable of removing a tree. Some of them will even talk you into an unnecessary removal. We take a different approach, where we assess risk and let the clients decide what path to take with their trees. People say tree pruning is like a haircut, but that isn't true at all. Every pruning cut stays with a tree for life. Large or improper cuts would decay and weaken the tree. Trees don't heal, they seal. You don't want someone making unnecessary or substandard cuts on your tree. We have the experience, reputation, and credentials to prove it. We have 6 certified arborists on staff, and I'm a board-certified master arborist with a master's degree in arboriculture and urban forestry. You have a choice in who you call. If you are looking for industry-leading professionals, choose Chris Francis Tree Care for all your pruning and tree care needs. Chris Francis Tree Care, 251-4-TREE, 367-8733.
Vince Allegri from Allegri Farm Market in Daphne, and what's on the farm this week?
Right now we got the fall vegetables, and they are pretty. We got large bunches of turnip greens, large bunches of collards. We gather those every day fresh for the market. Also, we're really picking some beautiful yellow squash, zucchini, okra, cucumbers, and pickling cucumbers.
While the produce is, of course, top of the line, best you can get, you also have all kinds of other goodies folks can pick up at Allegri Farm Market.
I'm going to Conecuh Sausage and Andalusia, their new facility, and pick up the order. We carry all their varieties.
And you've got some great stuff to help people out with making the home look fall ready, including these mums that you have on hand.
Yeah, we got our last load of mums in. They're really pretty. We also still have plenty of the pumpkins, all types. We have corn stalks and hay, too.
How can people find you, and also what hours are you open?
181 and 64 in Daphne. We're 4 miles south of I-10 at X38. We're open 7 days a week, 8 to 6, Monday through Saturday, 9 to 5 on Sunday.
Vince Allegri with Allegri Farm Market in Daphne, and that's what's on the farm this week.
It didn't matter to her that Southern Cancer Center is the area's only community-based cancer care team with specialists under one roof. Until it did. Southern Cancer Center. How we treat you matters most.
DJ K-Dub checking in. Previously on the Fine Bomb Show.
So one of the questions we're going to have is, how is the strength of our conference considered in determining participants for the playoff? It's not just about the column on the left side, the wins, nor is it just about having the smallest possible number, but it's the overall scope of the strength of schedule, the performance. You know, maybe I have different views, but I respect the committee has to make decisions.
The Paul Feinbaum Show, weekdays at 2 on FM Talk 106.5.
FM Talk 106.5 with Plain Living for Alabama and the Gulf Coast. Call 251-343-0106. Here again is your personal nature expert, Bill Finch.
Well, I knew I'd get a grumpy response from Jim in Georgetown if I mentioned the garlic dilemma, that we can't get our garlic a little earlier. You know, one thing on the Gulf Coast is you can put the garlic in the ground and get the greens, and they keep going, and that's kind of nice. And I don't know. It's just the way the shipping has gone here lately. I don't know. Jim, I wish I could help. Don't blame it on me. So we'd love to get the garlic in a little earlier, but now is fine. November's fine. It'll do fine. It'll still bulb up pretty nice, and in fact, it'll bulb up just as well. There is some evidence that maybe early planting doesn't allow it to bulb up quite as well. I'm not sure that's true, but garlic, great thing to do. Listen, we got some questions to get to before we run out of show. And one of those questions was, somebody said, Philip asked, I bought two satsumas at the plant sale. Should I greenhouse them until spring? Yes. I mean, I wouldn't keep them super warm over the winter. I would let them cool off. And so I don't really think, because then you're going to have a big transition in spring, because they won't have had, trust me, I would find a place where they get some sunlight. Here's what I would do. One way to do that, if you bought some citrus in fall, I only recommend this to people who are really prepared to do this, because fall is a terrible time to plant citrus. It's a great time to plant almost anything else. I always have to say this, a great time to plant almost anything else, except for citrus, and citrus is peculiar that way. You can leave it to get to cool down. That's great. But when the temperatures get below about 30 degrees, put it in the garage. It's that simple. And then when temperatures are above 30 degrees in the evenings, you can put it back out again. And it'll be fine. If you put it in a greenhouse and keep it growing all winter long, I think you're going to run into problems in the spring. And then we're going to have to transition you in spring, because spring is going to be a little cold and there's some chances of late frost, and your greenhouse is going to heat up too much. And I just don't think it's a good idea to do that just move it inside on the colder nights if you've got them in pots still. And you should, if you bought your citrus in fall, it's not a great time to plant citrus. Great time to plant everything else. But you're going to need to keep them in pots, ideally, and move them in and out of the garage just on those cold nights. It's that simple. Charlie Thigpen devised when we worked clay in Birmingham when we worked together at Southern Living. I use it for rattlesnake beans, and it couldn't be easier to use once it's constructed. You can see that it's a it's pretty cool, and So I'm gonna talk about that. It's a nice little thing. Growing parsnips. Somebody asked Clay. We're gonna come back to that next week. Growing parsnips. Yes, I have tried parsnips, and parsnips, this is a great time. You got to get the seeds started. It's one of the problems is the parsnip seeds don't start under really hot conditions. And so I think there's probably some interesting ways of doing that. And it might even be beneficial to sort of keep the seeds a little bit cool. But yes, this is the time of year to start parsnips. And I do think that they don't develop well under hot conditions, but they do well throughout the winter. They're incredibly tough. And I think, please, I haven't experimented with parsnips enough. I did experiment a little bit. I should have experimented more. Sometimes I think ants cart off your parsnip seeds like they do the carrot seeds. It drives me crazy, like it drives Bruce crazy. And Bruce, we're going to talk about that. Bruce, will you please call me back and let's talk about ants a little bit more next week, and how to control those ants, and we're going to think about that a little harder, because I haven't served you right if I don't. But parsnips are a good thing, I think, to start now. And on these cool nights, I think they're going to do well. I think they're going to germinate pretty well. I think you can get them up, and So parsnips, too. And this would be the time. Rhubarb is something else that people, if you're going to grow rhubarb, you're going to have to grow it as an annual in the South, mostly through the winter. It loves these winter temperatures, and then harvest it in the spring. Good thing to do. Good thing to think about if you're, but there, it's going to be an annual. It's going to be an annual. It should be in the ground. So what else we got? And Don, by the way, I love Genesis, and I don't watch the History Channel, but I do read the Book of Genesis, and it's really quite interesting, really quite wonderful how it describes the beginning of things, at the head of things. At the head of things. It's really cool. And there's many things in Genesis that I think we should pay close attention to, not what the History Channel says Genesis says, but what Genesis really says. Read the second chapter of Genesis really carefully, and it will tell you, you got to name things, buddy. That's your job. Because if you don't name them, you're not going to have a relationship with them. Yeah, well, watch out for the tornadoes. We'll be back next week.
Well, I can't hunt and I can't fish, but I can drive you crazy, yes I can.